Welcome to The Story Voice, a podcast of stories from great storytellers. I am Mary Edgerton, your host for this episode. My guests today are good friends and fellow storytellers, Michael Winters, Sneha Desai, and Hank Rubicek. Well, let's get right to the point. Ever had that bad date or just a bizarre encounter? Well, let us transport you to the Twilight Zone. Don't worry, I'll bring you all back and you will feel better for the experience, enriched in knowing that we are all members of the human race. Michael, I'd like to start with you first. And to our subscribers, listen closely to what Michael does as a living. Michael.
Well, thanks, Mary. It was about 30 years ago, and I did two things in succession. I graduated with a PhD in psychology, and the very next week, I got married. So, you know, I'd spent my whole life in the classroom waiting for life to begin, and now here I was. I'd hit it big. I had the education and the bride. I was ready for life to begin, and I was really excited. Now, I'd met my bride in the psychology program, and when we met a couple of years before this, she had been dating another guy, so I was hands off, but we got to be good friends. And I remember one night we went to a concert. There was supposed to be a group of us going, but it turned out that only the two of us went. And I felt really close to her that night. I wanted to kiss her, but that was out of bounds. I bided my time. Eventually, she ditched the other guy, and we got together. Now, unfortunately, this was late in May, and I was scheduled to go in August to another town, to Pittsburgh, for an internship. So we decided to get together, and we had a great summer. We got together physically, we connected emotionally, and as it came time for me to leave, we started having these conversations about, you know, long-distance relationships, how hard they are, and how usually they fizzle out. We weren't going to let that happen to us. So we started talking every day on the phone, and it was working. We were getting even closer, even though we were 1,000 miles apart. She was in Memphis, I was in Pittsburgh. And I remember one time we had this big conflict, and we were able to work it out on the phone, 1,000 miles apart. And I thought, well, if we can do that, then living in the same town should be a cinch. I traveled to New Jersey and met her New Jersey Jewish family, and they all seemed to like me. She came to Tennessee and met my Catholic family, 13 brothers and sisters, and everybody liked her. So, able to form a good emotional connection? Check. Able to form a good physical connection? Check. Able to work out conflict from 1,000 miles apart? Check. Ability to get along with each other's families? Check. I was ready, and I asked, and she said she would marry me. And we were having a great time. Still a long distance, about once a month we would find a way to get together for a weekend, but most of it was over the phone, and it was great. Until about May. Now, we'd planned an August wedding right after my graduation, and it was going great. And in May, she started seeming really annoyed with me for I couldn't understand what I'd done, but I figured I must be doing something that was annoying her, so I was going to try better. I vowed to do better. And then in July, she said, "I don't think I love you." Now, that should have been a giant red flag. But, you know, I was excited, and I thought, that's just the pre-marriage jitters. It's just cold feet. It's going to be fine. We've invited 200 people. No problem. And the wedding day was great. The wedding night was good. But the next day, the first full day of our marriage, was terrible. She didn't want me to touch her. So we finished the honeymoon. We went back to Memphis where she was still in school. I wasn't employed yet at the time. So I was staying home and did the laundry. One time, I messed up a sweatshirt of hers in the dryer, and she screamed at me, "You're so incompetent, you can't even do laundry." I was really perplexed. I didn't know what to do. Within 10 days of being married, she said, "I think this has all been a big mistake." So I got a job, and I started my job on a Thursday. The Monday before I started my job, she moved out. Now, we did go to a couple of marriage counseling sessions, but it was really no help because it became clear that she didn't want me. See, she'd like the idea of getting married, just not being married. Or maybe it was being married to me. But this was really painful because I hadn't even started my job and she was moving out. This is less than 9 weeks from our marriage to breaking up. And I was also really embarrassed because I was looking at psychology and looking at couples counseling as being a specialty. So we broke it off. She moved out. And now, as I look back at that time, you know, I'm really grateful. I mean, as hard as it might seem to think of gratitude as being my main emotion. See, I'm a very loyal person. I don't think I would have left her. But by setting me free, she allowed me to learn a lot more about myself. I think I'm a much better therapist, a much better, more sensitive human being by going through that experience. And I also became my own case study of how many different stressors a person can deal with. Within that 365 days, I had gotten married, I'd gotten a PhD in psychology, I'd gotten divorced, I'd moved from Pittsburgh to Memphis, been unemployed, found a temporary job, found a permanent job, moved to Houston, I'd lived in 4 different apartments, and bought 2 different couches. So the gratitude, though, is really that she released me. Because now, after being released, I was able to find Kelly, the woman to whom I've been married for over 25 years. That nightmare year turned into a life that I love.
Michael, that is so moving. And
thank you.
And give so much hope to people who expected so much out of one relationship or employment or something, anything, and then finds that being set free really does set you free.
Yep. It's hard to see it in the moment because you're just devastated. But when you can get enough distance and see, okay, this is how it's supposed to turn out.
That's great. You know, when I got divorced, in the middle of the day, I would just suddenly feel like I needed to go cry. And I would go outside. I said, it's just like rain in Hawaii. Every day at 1 o'clock, it happens. I'd go outside. I'd find a little place by myself. I'd cry. I'd come back inside. But then I discovered that he had been cheating on me. And that was it. It's the drought in Hawaii started. But, yeah. You know, I really do enjoy my life now, I have to say.
Yeah.
Let's bring on another storyteller. Sneha Desai, you're also a therapist, and all of us here know you're a great storyteller. Now, have you ever had a strange encounter, you know, not necessarily a 9-week marriage, but just something that happened in a way that wasn't what it was supposed to be?
Absolutely. I think that I've had many strange encounters in my practice, but here's one that I would like to share with all of you today. When I first arrived in the United States from India, specifically to Eastern Michigan University, Ypsilanti, which is a small town close to Ann Arbor, Michigan. I was an international student to pursue a master's degree in clinical psychology. The only other person I knew was my boyfriend, now an ex, who went to school in Big Rapids, Michigan, 3 hours away. Now, during my very first semester, I was supposed to administer an IQ test to a child between the ages of 6 and 16 years for a class assignment. Where the heck was I supposed to find a child on campus when I didn't even know enough adults on campus? And my professor wasn't very helpful either. Can you imagine an international student walking around asking people to borrow their child for a few hours, only to return them after a few hours and let them know that their child isn't a genius like they thought? I mean, everyone in America seems so friendly and all, random strangers smiling at me, asking me how I'm doing and walking away without a response. But still, it just seemed odd to me to do that, you know? In any case, I visited my boyfriend, who, by the way, had already been in the United States for 18 months by this time. And so I visited him the weekend for the IQ test administration was due. And I wondered if he knew of any children I could test. And his solution was for me to knock on his distant neighbor's door because they happened to have Mickey Mouse stickers on their windows. And it seemed like a great idea because, hey, I would get to see what an American home looks like on the inside and get to know more people and possibly finish my assignment. So I walked over to the next building, to the second floor, and knocked on the door, which had the sticker-filled windows. And a really tall, bearded man, kind of athletic, answered the door. To be honest, he was a little scary looking. And at 5 feet 2 inches tall, he was at least a foot taller than me, and I looked like a dwarf in front of him. I managed to mumble that I needed to borrow a child and wondered if he had any. And he said, "Sure, which one do you want?" And his casual demeanor was super encouraging, so I began to be a little bit more enthusiastic. So I said, "Which one would you like to offer?" So he gave me a choice between a 9-month-old, a 2-year-old, an 8-year-old, and a 12-year-old. And the 9-month-old and the 2-year-old, while seemed pretty cute, were not between 6 and 16. So I blindly picked the 8-year-old and then proceeded to explain to him what I needed the child for. But he didn't seem too interested in knowing the reason. I promised to return the next day for the test, and I did. Except this time, the man wasn't there. Thankfully, a lady who looked like she was in her 20s knew what I was there for and welcomed me in. And she set me up at the kitchen table with the 8-year-old as she and her mother watched The Bold and the Beautiful just about 6 feet away, and a 9-month-old cooed and crawled around the apartment. And it was super loud and chaotic and totally not an environment to administer a test, but I needed this dang IQ test. So halfway through the test, the women started shrieking and running from window to window and room to room in a state of panic. And one of them picked up the phone and called the leasing office and said, "Don't let them come to her apartment," and hung up. Then she made another phone call and screamed, "They're coming, they're coming." The 8-year-old started squirming, and I had no idea what was going on, and it felt like I was in some kind of a sci-fi movie where maybe aliens were approaching, but it was like a secret for me, and everyone else seemed to know what was going on. The child was distracted, and I started fearing an F on my assignment, my first semester in the United States, and an F in my first class. What a nightmare. I started rushing the kid through the IQ test. "What's a cow? What's a scissors?" I started shouting these questions out loud in quick succession. Hurry up," I remember saying. But it wasn't enough time. Within minutes, we heard a loud knock on the door, followed by banging and, "Open up, It's the police. Turns out, the police were looking for the man that I had encountered the previous day. Why? Because this bright-eyed baby that was crawling around during our test was in fact a kidnapped child. And our giant neighbor was the kidnapper. The police attempted to ask me a few questions, but I was shaking and I can't remember what I mumbled. I just remember the woman saying, "Let her go, she knows nothing." Thankfully, she had the decency to say that. And I remember sprinting out of that apartment and running to my boyfriend's apartment as fast as I could with the whole IQ test kit. I went back to campus on Monday and told my professor what happened and why I hadn't finished my assignment. She seemed poker-faced and simply told me to find another child since my test was invalid. I don't remember who I found, and I don't remember what kind of an IQ test that was and what happened, but I'm a practicing psychologist now, so I clearly did eventually pass the class. Moral of the story, please don't go knocking on strange people's doors just because you see Mickey Mouse stickers on their window.
That's perfect. And that certainly beats the dog ate my homework story.
Yes.
Oh my gosh, that's great. And there's a reason why you remember that experience and not the real one.
Yeah, because I think the actual IQ test that got me my grade was pretty uneventful.
Hopefully. Sneha, thank you. We are coming now to our third storyteller, and that's Hank Rubicek. He's our show's producer and a professor of communications. Now, Hank, you and I share that wonderful world of having to learn how to date again at, let's say, a mature stage in life. I'll never forget sitting out a dinner date for 2 hours just to break my streak of 15-minute first dates, and not just one when I say streak. How about you? How were you able to communicate with a stranger on a date?
Well, you know, Mary, it's funny because, you know, we have trillions of people who experience the same thing as you and I do. But, you know, like Michael, I may know a lot about communication, but it doesn't mean I do it very well. Okay. So when we talk about communicating with women on first dates, I'm not sure I'm anything remotely close to a role model. But I will tell you this. One of the things that I have found, just to kind of lay the groundwork, is that unfortunately, and I want to emphasize this word, it's usually about, at least initially, it's about superficiality. In other words, who's attractive? Who gives you a good vibe? What does your instinct tell you? And it's unfortunate because if you're on a dating site and you are thinking about asking someone out on a date, you don't have a whole lot to go by. You have photos, which, as we know, are ridiculous. Guys have photos that were taken 1,000 years ago when they were baseball players in high school, or, you know, doing shots on Cancun Island. Women all have theirs taken between 1964 and 1973, and they're doing glamour shots. You know, I know that this is an audio podcast, but it's sort of like, you know, that kind of a image. So all the women look absolutely gorgeous, right? They're all beautiful, absolutely all of them. So that's one of the dilemmas. And that's what brings me to the first of a very bizarre experience. I saw this one woman who I was very attracted to, and she said, so we decided to meet for a drink. And it was a Friday night, it was really crowded, and we met at a favorite bar around the Highland Village area in Houston. I know our subscribers don't all live here. A very congested part of the town. So I'm walking into a bar looking for this person. And why shouldn't I? I have her photograph. I know what she looks like, right? I'm looking around. And I see no one that even comes within waving distance of this person. I walk out of the bar thinking, oh, I'm stood up. And as I'm walking out of the bar, I hear, Hank, Hank. At first, I thought God was talking to me, but then I knew right away that couldn't be the case. It was this woman whose name was Jill. She looked like she ate Jill. Now, I am not a person who cares about anybody's weight. I do care a great deal about deception, right? So I see her, I play really dumb, which I'm good at doing, saying, oh, I didn't see you. Now, I'm not exaggerating when I tell you that this is an individual who was significantly larger than her photo would have demonstrated. Now, there's a cafe part of this bar outside, so we sit down, we have a drink, and she's very nice. I mean, she's really one of the nicest people that I've spoken to in years. And we remained friends for a long time. And I asked her, about midway through this drink, I said, why is it that you misled me with your photograph? And she said, well, if you would have seen what I really look like, would you have wanted to meet me? I said, honestly, I don't know. But I do know that I certainly don't want to meet anybody who's deceptive. And the problem that I have right now is that you're such a nice person. You are such a nice person. It's unfortunate that that isn't seen in a photograph. So that was one really strange episode. I was kind of proud of myself of how it went and not so proud of the way that I felt initially. But you know, the content in a lot of this dating sites are also very misleading. Forget about the photographs. I know for a fact because seven guys paid me over $1,000 to write answers on their dating site, and two women did as well. So it's not just a gender thing. I made a lot of money doing that. And the other problem is that you just can't trust the things that you read, right? So I'm meeting a woman who, again, very attractive, really sounds bright, very intellectual, loved the arts. We had a lot in common. And she wanted to meet on 45. I'm always skeptical when someone says, let's meet on a highway. Like, isn't there a potato? Oh, yeah, there's like a Papa seafood restaurant. I said, you want to meet at a seafood restaurant on 45 in the Third Ward? Okay, fine. For people who don't know, it's not the best area of town. I can think of many more romantic excursions. So we meet at this, at the bar part of this restaurant. We see each other. We sit down. And the first thing she says is, look. I mean, you can't even make this stuff up. This is like a Larry David episode, you know. She said, look, I don't know how to say this, so I'm just going to come right out with it. There are two guys that I want to meet, and you're one of them. Because I'm a lesbian and I want a guy to try to turn me around. And I said, wait, whoa. Congratulations to this other gentleman. He wins. And I left. That was another very strange episode. The third one, oh, I got a bunch of them, but I'll leave you with the third. The third was a woman that I met at a bar. These are always at bars or coffee shops, at a bar. And this was just, I don't know which of these three were most bizarre. I was going through a really bad time. And Mary, you know, Michael, we can all relate to this kind of stuff. We go through a very difficult time. It wasn't just a time of dating. You know, there are moments when you're just out of maybe a relationship or certainly out of your marriage, and you're feeling particularly depressed. And, you know, I suffer from depression anyway, so it wasn't easy. It wasn't difficult for me to really plumb it down. So I'm sitting here with this young woman, this woman, and about my age. We were all young in those days. This woman, to be exact, I had just turned 50, actually, which nowadays sounds awfully young. So we're talking, and this is no big deal, but I want subscribers to listen to this. I've had a lot of accomplishments in my life. I've written 4 books. I've won teaching awards. I've won research awards, community service awards. I was the youngest person in the state of Texas to be tenured. There are a lot of things that I'm very proud of, but apparently this person was turned off because I didn't own a home. That's right. You heard that right. Talk about first interviews. So where do you live? And how do you live? Do you live with anybody? And I told her I rent an apartment. She said, did you say you rented an apartment? I said, yeah, I rent an apartment. You mean you don't own a home? No, I don't own a home. I don't even want to own a home. I don't want to own anything. I don't want any responsibility right now. I'm going through a hard time, right? And that was about, I shouldn't have even said that much. She said, well, and I don't even know how to say this without busting out all over. She said, I don't date men unless they own a home because it tells me a lot about their level of success. And all I could say was, well, what you just said tells me an awful lot about your character. So we left. I left. I didn't even think I said goodbye. And she followed me and she said, you know, I know you want me to apologize, but this is the way that I am. I said, oh, I know that's the way you are. Don't worry about that. And then she saw me get in my car, and it gets even better. I was driving a Honda Civic. And she said, and you have a Civic. So this is a person who in 10 minutes just was not impressed by me at all. Not because of my books and my accomplishments, not because of any of that, but because I didn't own a home and I was driving a goddamn Honda Civic. So there you have it. Now, those three encounters really stay in my mind. There are more, but I'm sure nobody has the time or the patience to listen to them, but they get the idea. First encounters of the very strangest kind. Yes, Mary, you're right. Dating, like getting old, is hell.
It absolutely is, I have to say. In reference to your first story about being receptive, I want to tell you a story. I knew this guy in college, which at age 45 was a long time before, and that was at the University of Texas at Austin. And I had moved several times, 25 years had passed. I was living in Nashville, Tennessee, and my best friend was another pathologist, and she was getting ready to go on a date with someone that she met online. And she tells me the name, and it just that doesn't sink in. And then she tells me that he went to the University of Texas also and also studied physics. And it just didn't click. And then all of a sudden, a couple of days later, I said, I think I know him. We were in class together. In fact, I kind of had a little crush on him, and maybe he had one on me. And she says, no, couldn't be. You see, he had shaved 10 years off his age. Couldn't be. I said, you know, how many people, he had a rather unusual name, how many people have that name? And physics is a pretty small community. She says, nope, couldn't be. Anyway, about 10 o'clock that night, right after I'd put my kids to bed, I get one of those phone calls from the bathroom of a restaurant saying, it's him, he remembers you. And they actually are very happily married now. So they, he told her that it was his son who filled out his profile. So
I love that follow-up. I do want everybody to know that ironically, I met the woman of my dreams, you know, my wife Peggy, and all three of you know her. And when I say that she is the most magnificent woman God ever created, that is not hyperbole. She really is magnificent. The funny part is that we did meet on a dating site. I was dating for about 12 years and I said, I've had it. I'm gone. I've had it. And I was actually given a month free. And that's when I got back on this dating site and she had just gotten on. And that's how we met. So dating sites aren't all bad.
That's a wonderful ending. Well, everybody, it's time to bring you back to our regular three-dimensional world. But don't forget to check out our Facebook page, The Story Voice, and pass the word along about this great little podcast of ours. So y'all come back now. But before we do sign off, thank you, Michael Winters, Sneha Desai, and Hank Rubicek. And thank you to our subscribers for making this journey with us. I want you to know that no relationships were hurt in the recording of this story. We are all leading our lives, knowing that it's not the destination, but the journey that is the best part of living. Peace.